Well, thank you very much. You know, it is believed likely that some form of inoculation was developed in India or China before the 16th century. We're talking about powdered scabs from people infected with smallpox used to protect against the disease. And, you know, there was the, when I was a kid, there was the whole polio scare, and there was smallpox was out of control. So clearly vaccines have been a good thing in the development of civilization. However, these things we inoculate ourselves against have a way of, well, as Howard Bloom was speaking earlier, they're in a, these things that want to attack us and use us as their host. They are ever changing, ever trying to get around these defenses we throw up. So what is all of this about? Oh, there's mercury in it. It's inducing autism. It's causing problems. I've even heard strokes, things like this. I want to know about this. And Howard Bloom is here. He will be back in just a moment to tell us about that. And I'm interested how he happened to know anything about this. I'm no epidemiologist. I'm not a doctor. But I don't know. No, there's no time to become a doctor. We'll leave it to Bloom. All right, back with him in just a moment. Thank you very much for being here. This is Coast to Coast AM. Do stand by. Howard Bloom, how did you become interested in vaccines at all? How did you become knowledgeable about them?
Well, when I was a kid, when I was 10 years old, basically nobody in Buffalo, New York, my hometown, wanted to have anything to do with me. I was saved by Galileo and Anton van Leeuwenhoek. Anton van Leeuwenhoek was the inventor of the microscope. I mean, these two guys seemed willing to invite me into their little project called science, and they couldn't say no to me. You know, all the kids in Buffalo could say no. These two guys couldn't say no because they were dead, John.
Yes, isn't it amazing? We learn once our friends abandon us.
Yes, so I there I was at 10 into microbiology and theoretical physics, and by 16 I was working at the world's largest cancer research facility, the Roswell Park Memorial Cancer Research Institute in Buffalo, New York, doing research on, guess what, on immunology, on the immune system. And the immune system and vaccines are all a matter of what we were talking before in the previous hour, war. Remember we talked about the fact that at the very beginning of life, 3.85 billion years ago, bacterial colonies went to war against each other?
Yes.
Armies of 7 trillion, and using weapons of mass destruction, using chemical weapons, using the weapons we've stolen from them and have called antibiotics. Well, that kind of, I mean, we are the descendants of these large collectives, intelligent collectives of bacterial cells. And as a consequence, we still have a bacterial army, a microbial army inside our body. It's called the immune system. And it's massive. It consists of individual cells working with each other the way that the cells in a bacterial colony work with each other, constantly swapping intelligence. Intelligence is the key to the way the immune system operates. Bacteria try to sneak in, disguising themselves as part of your own body. The immune system knows how to tell what's really part of your own body and what's not, up to a point. Because bacteria are constantly evolving their disguises to really look like part of us, the immune system can occasionally be fooled by a new bacterial invention, a new bacterial camouflage. And when that happens, the immune system has got to get wise to this new invader. Well, one way to get it wise to the new invader is take a little piece of the invader and insert it into the body so that the immune system comes to recognize it and as a consequence can attack that invader the next time it appears. That's okay. What immunizing us does. That's what vaccines do. They give us little snippets of the things that are about to attack us. So our immune system can learn that snippet the way you would train a dog by giving it somebody's socks and then sending it off in search of that person. And so they make our immune system smarter. It's like a postgraduate course for the immune system when you give it a vaccine.
All right, well, let's get down to cases now then. Now, I don't want to make you roll your eyes with some of these questions, but I don't want to go from the bottom up as quickly as we can. These vaccines are not universally effective. So I guess depending upon an individual's, you know, physical constitution, is that going to determine how effective a vaccine is or is not?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, because when vaccines were introduced to the West, as you implied, they were introduced to the West from Turkey, and they were introduced in 1719. And people, a woman named Lady Mary Wortley Montague, was operating as an ambassador. Her husband was the ambassador to Turkey, and she noticed that there were old ladies in Turkey who specialized in the beginning of the fall, in the beginning of the illness, the season of illness.
Yeah.
They'd get together big parties of people, and they would put little bits of smallpox into these people from a little nut. And the people, as a consequence, would survive. Now, smallpox was a huge problem in Europe and in the Americas at that time. But Turkey had almost no problem with smallpox whatsoever. But there was a problem using this stuff right from the very beginning. A few people would have a negative reaction to it and would die. However, the number of people in total who would die of something like smallpox was the tiniest fraction of those who would die without the inoculation. So when she introduced smallpox vaccine into England, the most unlikely person in the world took up its cause in the United States. It was Cotton Mather, the guy who was behind persecuting witches in places like Salem, Massachusetts. But Cotton Mather wanted to be a member of the Royal Society, and he promoted vaccination like crazy, and he was right. And he worked with a physician to introduce vaccination to Boston. The guy who opposed him, you know, we already had yellow journalism in the United States. We already had wild scare headlines that were wildly out of proportion. And there was a guy who owned a paper called the New England Courant, and he didn't like what Cotton Mather was doing, and basically accused Cotton Mather of threatening to kill off the whole population of New England with this crazy idea of putting little bits of smallpox into people. And his name was James Franklin. His younger brother was named Benjamin.
Right.
Well, Benjamin didn't agree with his older brother, and Benjamin became one of the leading proponents of vaccination in the United States. So most of the founding fathers were vaccinated. Then we get up to 1998. We take a quick step forward in time. And in 1998, there was a report by a guy named Dr. Andrew Wakefield that said that he had demonstrated that vaccination against measles, mumps, and rubella caused autism. And that took off like crazy. And now there are parents' groups dedicated to the idea that vaccination causes autism. Now, there were a few problems with Wakefield's research. His research had been limited to 12 kids.
Yeah.
And when a careful examination was made of his research, it turns out that he had falsified the results. We can go into detail on how he'd falsified it, but eventually the publication, the journal that had published his initial study, The Lancet, which is Britain's leading journal on medicine, I mean, highly prestigious, was forced to rescind the article. And then Wakefield was basically, he was sent into a state of humiliation because everything that he had said was disproven.
Okay.
But parents still believe in this. Now, the question is, why do parents believe in it? Because nobody remembers what you remember and what I remember. Nobody remembers the days when people had polio and when your parents were afraid to let you go out and play with other kids.
Especially in the summer heat. I just mentioned that last night.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, remember how terrible polio was? There were kids in your class who had withered arms and withered legs. A friend of mine managed to survive polio, but it weakened him so profoundly that he looked healthy when he was a kid, and he went out when he was a teenager and a young man and had all kinds of adventures in South America and in the Middle East. But when he turned 65, the weakness caught up with him, and he died at the age of 65. Now, to me, a guy about to turn 70, 65 looks young. Very young. So polio was a major, major problem, and so was smallpox. A person like Benjamin Franklin stood a very good chance of never making it to middle age because smallpox was rampaging through towns like Boston and Philadelphia,
Well, so we know the vaccines work. I mean, I don't mean to jump in here, but...
Well, again, it is as if your body has a badge of identification. It's called an MHC, Major Histocompatibility Complex. It's a little...
So it's not...
It's a little molecular badge that says, hey, I'm one of us.
Okay.
So every cell in your body's got one of these, got these MHCs that say, hey, I'm one of us. So when the patrollers of the immune system, when the armies of the immune system go stalking through the body looking for enemies, every cell shows its badge. Okay, it's fine. It's one of us.
Yeah.
What happens is that bacteria are very clever, and they're constantly inventing new ways to disguise themselves.
Well, exactly. I mean, like this latest flu epidemic, you know, the increasingly larger portions of the continental United States are turning red. You know, there we go. It's everywhere. But
well, what these things do is they basically manufacture an imitation of the badge that says, I'm one of us.
But isn't it last year's virus?
Well, last year's virus has last year's attempt to outwit our immune system, and this year's virus has some new variations.
But let me get this straight, Howard. Is it a different virus, or is it the same virus that's still exists, and somehow it trains itself to go around last year's vaccine?
It is.
Or are they different? Are they different?
It's in the same family of viruses, but viruses evolve so quickly that this year's strain of last year's virus is almost like a different virus, especially in those years when they get a particularly clever twist in their research and development.
Well, I don't mean to just keep beating this horse, but isn't the strain slightly different than the year before?
Yes, yes.
Well, how do you vaccinate against something that hadn't hit you yet?
Because the new viruses come from China. And they come from China because people have very small farms in China in which they have ponds for their ducks, they have hogs, and they have humans. And when they take out what they call their night garbage, when they take out their feces, they dump them in the pond so that bacteria in the pond can eat them up, and the bacteria become food for the ducks. Now, passing avian creatures, you know, passing geese, and wild ducks come and visit. And those wild geese and new ducks carry new strains of an avian flu. That is a flu that infects birds.
Yes.
And some of those strains manage to figure out how to get from the geese and the wild geese and ducks into the hogs. Hogs are very similar to humans. Once you've made the jump into pigs, it becomes easier to make the jump into human beings.
Yes, that's what I understand. So is this all basically all of it an avian flu variant?
Almost everything that we get, almost all of the vaccines that we're given are for avian flu variants. And there are the World Health Organization has outposts, especially in Singapore and Hong Kong, that keep an eye out for anything new developing in China, Hong Kong, and Singapore.
And
when
how long
they
does it
find
take?
Something they think is going to take off as the big flu of the year, they develop a vaccine for it as rapidly as they can, and they spread that vaccine around the world.
Well, I was just getting ahead of you a little bit. Sorry about that, but you got me all fired up here. How long does it take to put a vaccine together? Do you have a handle on that?
I don't really have a handle on it, but it looks to me like it's about 4 months to 6 months. A lot depends on who the manufacturers are. 5 years ago, vaccines were such a low-profit business that almost nobody wanted to manufacture them, and we had severe vaccine shortages. Now, all of a sudden, vaccines are beginning to look as if they're going to make a profit again, especially new vaccines that haven't quite been developed yet. So Big Pharma is dipping its toe into vaccinations again. But we have a major problem when there's a problem in our supply chain and no company really wants to make vaccines.
Well, we got another problem, and it's this the continual use of the term autism. Which
yes.
Apparently there's it's centered earlier on a mercury-containing preservative called thimerosal, widely used in vaccines, but...
Well, the point really is that autism, we didn't hear much talk about autism when we were kids and the talk was about polio.
Yeah.
And we didn't even hear much talk about autism 20 years ago. And then within the last 20 years, autism became a fashionable term. And now there are people who have autism who are in horrible, horrible, horrible shape, far worse than Rain Man in the movie, which is a movie about a guy with autism, far, far worse than that. They can't communicate with their fellow human beings. They spend their time jumping up and down and screaming at the ceiling. It's very difficult to deal with them, extremely difficult. And parents who have kids who have that kind of autism are really profoundly to be pitied and to be given every bit of help that we can possibly give. But autism took off as a fad. It took off as a fashionable diagnosis. And the result was that within a two-year period, the rate of diagnosed autism went up 28%. Within something like 7 years, it went up 78%. And the people who could, there are people who put together something called the DSM. That is the manual used to diagnose people. And they realized that this autism business was getting out of control. So they totally revised for the 2013 edition, which comes out in May. They've totally revised the categories of what's called autism spectrum disorder. And the result should be that less galloping, fashionable diagnoses of autism for people who are marginal. I would have been diagnosed with autism when I was a kid. Remember, none of the kids in Buffalo and New York liked me. I was apparently lacking in social skills. A kid like me would have been diagnosed as having autism spectrum disorder.
Now, is that on the level, Howard? I mean, that sounds like a little bit of a stretch, you know?
No, I would have been diagnosed as having Asperger's, and which is about to be phased out of the new DSM, the new manual. And many of my friends in science, I mean, we're all outsiders, John. We're all rebels. Why are we rebels? Because we never quite fit in socially. And that's been a huge advantage for us. And it's provided an advantage to the society that's kind enough to listen to us.
Wait a second. Am I misunderstanding here? Or are you drawing a parallel between behavior and something that otherwise is neurological or not?
Well, we don't know what the cause neurologically is of autism. Certainly taking a look at kids who have serious autism, there's something very, very, very wrong. And there's something wrong with the parts of their brain that are dedicated to social skills. They're really missing those skills. But people like one of my friends in neurobiology and I both would have definitely been diagnosed with Asperger's if instead of growing up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 70s, we had grown up in the 90s. Or okay. In the early 2000s. And Asperger's is considered to be on the autism, it's an autism spectrum disorder, though as I said, it's about to be drummed out of the DSM, the manual that people use to diagnose things.
Well, this is, now, we were talking about autism, but this is something that gets to me. Just vet this information for me, I'll be brief, okay? This is from Sandy. And she says, vaccines may at times be useful. However, as a pediatric nurse, I took care of an infant who had a documented severe reaction at age 6 months that caused her to develop neurological problems. That was about 20 years ago. Now we give one-day-olds hepatitis B vaccines. But never mind the bad things in vaccines. The point is that neonates up to one-month-olds have no immune system. And you need an immune system in order for the vaccine to work, at least in theory. So...
Well, I severely doubt that neonates do not have an immune system, and I would imagine the immune system develops somewhere around the third or fourth month of gestation. But that is a guess, John. I haven't looked that up.
You couldn't even come out into the air if you didn't have an immune system.
That's right. And in fact, the immune system is such a basic part of childhood that one of the things we've been learning is that, you know, there are a lot more kids coming down with asthma these days. Are they coming up with asthma because they've been vaccinated? Not by a long shot. It turns out they're coming up with asthma because they haven't been allowed to play in the dirt enough to train their immune systems to handle rugged circumstances. Now, okay. Is playing in the dirt going to do a few kids harm? Absolutely. But it's a necessity.
Well, you know what they say, Howard. If you want to get a good tomato, guess what you have to put on the plant. All right. Very good.
I'm glad you didn't specify.
No, yeah, this is a family-oriented program, man. You know that. Okay, we'll be back with Howard Bloom in just a moment. We may have time for a call or two. I don't know, but I want to talk a little bit about his book, and I still want to find out if mercury is still a common component in common vaccines. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thanks, sir. It's a pleasure to be in with you tonight. Tell you what, let's just talk to Howard right now rather than doing the usual go to the break, because Howard... You know, this is almost like a 6-hour medical course in two. But
that's terrific.
Do you vaccinate against viruses exclusively? You don't vaccinate against bacteria, is that correct?
No, I think you do vaccinate against bacteria. An awful lot of the things that you vaccinate against are bacterial. Whooping cough, for example, is bacterial. And because people stopped getting vaccinations for whooping cough, or some people did, it became very fashionable not to vaccinate your kids or yourself. We've had outbreaks of whooping cough, and those have killed 12 infants. Infants are very susceptible to whooping cough, and people who are around infants, that is, parents and friends and grandparents, should be vaccinated against whooping cough, or they're likely to kill the kid. And when you asked about mercury before the break, too, well, the mercury problem, first of all, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, says that all of the evidence tends to indicate that mercury does not, the form of mercury used and the dosages in which it's used doesn't do any harm. But just in case there's harm, the Center for Disease Control and the American Pediatric Academy of Pediatrics asked in 1999 that this stuff called thiomersal, which is the form of mercury that's used in very tiny amounts in vaccines, be removed, and by now almost all of it is gone. Nonetheless, the lines of evidence, at least in mainstream science, tended to indicate that, yes, thiomersal could contribute to the swelling that you get when you get a vaccination and the redness that you get when you get a vaccination, but no, they didn't cause any further problems, and they're gone. They're almost entirely gone now.
All right. Now, the vaccine is the preventative. The antibiotic is the weapon that you use once you've got it, but antibiotics are not effective against flu. Is that correct or not?
Antibiotics are not effective against flu. They are those weapons of mass destruction that bacterial colonies make in order to destroy other bacterial colonies utterly.
It just kills everything.
They're bacterial, and there can be problems for autism there because there, you know, you have about 1,000 different species of bacteria living in your gut, and they are extremely important to you. They make your vitamin B, they make your vitamin K, and they digest a lot of the food that you can't eat for all practical purposes. As far as bacteria are concerned, you're a giant walking vehicle that goes shopping on their behalf and then chews the food so they can digest it. And
they
excrete glucose, which is the stuff that you can use as food. And there are only 10 trillion cells of you, and there are 100 trillion cells of the bacteria living within your body and on your body, and they garrison your body. They are armies on your body. They protect your body against invaders. So antibiotics, if you use antibiotics and you start killing a lot of the bacteria in your gut, you can set yourself up for problems, and you have to take probiotics. You have to replace the microflora, it's called, in your gut. Those bacteria are very, very important to you, and antibiotics can be a problem for them.
Howard, we've explored got into it a little bit, the part about catchphrases. You know, like ADD to me is a catchphrase, and this
ADD.
Yeah, me too. I call it multiple attention capability.
Yeah,
or MAC,
fantastic. I love it.
But here's the thing: could a case be made for between the antibiotics, including the stuff you drink in your water that you don't filter out because you don't have a filter, which people have alleged is not neutralized by any of the other chemicals that are added to the water, such as chlorine and fluoride. Could a case be made for the immune systems in persons en masse be compromised between the combination of the antibiotics and the vaccines? So is that where all this autism could be coming from? Because there sure is a lot of it.
Because remember, the vaccines smarten your immune system. They sharpen your immune system. They make it work better. The antibiotics kill a lot of the bacteria that you need to live with. So, yes, eat a lot of yogurt if you've been taking antibiotics. That has live bacterial cultures, and you need those. But here's the bottom line, John. If you and I had been born in 1850, we would have had a life expectancy of 38.5 years. If we had been born in 2000, we'd have had a life expectancy of 78.5 years. And if we had been born in Japan, we would have had a life expectancy of over 80 years. That's more than doubling the human lifespan. So we have people who say that that the electrical waves coming from high-capacity electrical lines are killing us, that the additives in our food are killing us, that vaccines are killing us, that modern living is killing us. If it's killing us, why are we living over twice as long as we used to live?
Well, you got a point, and the baseline goes up with the more people you have in your population.
How so? Explain that to me.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, if you have a 100-person colony, and you have, in other words, as our population numbers increase, naturally there are going to be more reported cases. But it's not if you have a 100-person colony,
right,
and one person, you got 1%.
Right.
If you got a million people, it's
like
a little bit different.
From Andrew Beckwith, 12 people. And then the results falsified. So you could pick 12 people who are a victim of almost anything you want in a very, very big population. You're absolutely right. But the fact is that on the whole, we have benefited. Look, remember how much Chinese emperors were willing to pay to live an extra 4 years, much less an extra 40 years. They would be willing to give up all the wealth they had ever accumulated in their lives. And still, they couldn't get the 4 years. In fact, they were taking large amounts of mercury to increase their longevity, and it was killing them 3 to 4 to 5 years earlier than they would have died otherwise.
Okay. This is pretty amazing. All right, so what's your take on a big pharma conspiracy? We've manufactured a bunch of vaccines. We've got to get them out there. I mean, is it all money in the end, or it can't be?
First of all, remember that 5 years ago, companies were going broke making vaccines. So it can't just be Big Pharma.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier. Yeah,
because Big Pharma's only been getting re-involved in the last couple of years. And let's take a look at Big Pharma. And I have been up against death several times in my life. It's always been exhilarating. It's always been an adventure. And I've always survived somehow. But I've been saved by Big Pharma over and over again. When I was a kid, I had insomnia. I just could not sleep. The stress of school was too much for me because I'd never paid attention in school before. I'd always read 2 books a day, reading under the desk, and now my parents wanted me to study, and I promised them I would. So I had insomnia. My uncle, a doctor, gave me an early tranquilizer. Hey, I was now able to sleep on Sunday nights before school started. I didn't take them very often. I probably took about 4 or 5 of them, but boy, did they help. Then I almost died at the age of 16 of hepatitis and was saved by mainstream medicine. I almost died again at the age of 19 when I had a huge kidney stone, and I was saved by Big Pharma. I was in bed for 15 years in the days when Art Bell and George Norrie and I started talking to each other 12 years ago or so. I'd been in bed. I was stuck in bed for 15 years.
Yeah, and you're about to turn 70, and you're doing 190 push-ups now?
Yeah, and Big Pharma saved me. It was stuff called gabapentin that saved me. Another thing called, well, the two things that aren't made by Big Pharma, and it's hard to get because they aren't made by Big Pharma. One is an injectable vitamin B12, and the other is injectable oxytocin. I wish Big Pharma were making them because then I'd have an easier time getting them. So Big Pharma has saved me over and over again.
Okay, I got you. All right, let's take our break right now. When we come back, if you feel like it, we'll take a couple of calls, but I want to save a few minutes for you to talk about your new book, okay?
Okay, terrific.
All right, we'll be back with Howard Bloom in just a moment. This is the one, the only Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Howard, you feel like taking a call from Stephanie on Wildcard Line number 2?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
She wants to talk to you. Come on, Stephanie.
Hello, are you there?
Good evening, yes.
Hi. I just have I was wondering if you could expand on your theory. You were talking about asthma and kids needing to play outdoors more often. I was wondering where you got that from.
It's a common hypothesis these days in medicine. It's called the hygiene hypothesis. It arose about 15 years ago. And 15 years ago, there was this hypothesis that if kids were not raised in such spectacularly clean environments, if they were not raised in such spectacularly hygienic environments, they would have less asthma. Why? Because the immune system needs to train itself. It's like exercising. Your muscles are flabby if you do not exercise them. That's why I do push-ups. And the same thing happens with the immune system. The immune system needs to be trained on a variety of soft enemies. in order to be strong enough to handle the hard enemies. And the amount of research on that has been substantial over the last 15 years.
All right, excellent. Stephanie, thank you very much for the call. Let's go quickly to Les in Fairlawn, New Jersey. Les, are you there? East of the Rockies, yeah.
Good morning. I had just told the screener that I wanted to ask about antibiotics, and then you started to talk about it. But let me just mention a few things. Several times I've seen news reports about an autistic child, and the preface was that little Johnny seemed healthy, except he was taking antibiotics for an ear infection, or he was taking antibiotics because he had an injury, and then suddenly he got these odd symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. Even two people who testified before Congress, they thought it was a vaccine, but when someone asked them, were their children taking any other medication at the same time, one said, only some antibiotics, and the other said, only some antibiotics. I know it's just a few cases, but there's also some animal studies. I don't have the references handy, but there's also some animal studies where they gave animals various toxins, sometimes mercury, sometimes other toxins, sometimes infections.
Okay.
And they wanted the animals to get sick so they could study the symptoms that resulted. So in order to weaken them, first they gave them antibiotics. And that made it more likely that they would get symptoms from the mercury or various other toxins or infections.
Right. Well, there is a factual basis to a little bit of this. We all take antibiotics. So as
Thanks,
John
Les.
Said before, when you have a very big population base, you're going to get a couple of exceptions that allow you to make something look as if it's happening when it's not really happening. We all take antibiotics. But again, you've got these between 1,000 and 2,000 different species of bacteria living in your gut. And some of those bacteria actually can influence your moods and your behavior. For example, some bacteria produce a fatty acid called propione. And propione, if you give it to rats, it decreases their social abilities. So there is a thin cord of connection to autism there, but it hasn't been followed up with sufficient research to demonstrate that there is any connection. And the big one of the solutions to antibiotics is probiotics. Remember to take some form of probiotic or yogurt or something of the sort to repopulate your gut with your bacterial complement after you've done antibiotics.
Always, yeah, yeah. Antibiotics will just flat lock your system up. How often did we? I can't remember. It's been so long since I've had a vaccination. Didn't we do them every 3 years?
Yeah,
some of them were every two.
It had to be done on a very steady schedule when we were kids, and we're supposed to get them renewed as adults, and I'm ashamed to say I haven't gotten mine renewed. But again, we have to get them renewed because if we don't get them renewed and we're carrying, even if we're carrying a disease like smallpox or rubella or whooping cough that is not making us sick, it can make somebody more susceptible than we are sick. So we can be a danger to other people if we don't get our schedule of vaccinations.
You mean as a carrier?
Yeah, we can be carriers. Exactly.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think it's possible? Let's just go out on the clothesline for a second. Do you think it's possible that over a couple of generations that there might be some sort of an alteration to the genetic makeup of the human being as we go along, which makes them more susceptible to more things because of the accumulation of antibiotics and vaccines in our systems? I mean, I wonder if they rewrite a little piece of code somewhere, because I've never seen so much. We've never seen levels of autism like this.
Well, remember, we didn't have a concept of autism until relatively recently. It's a 20th century concept. So we had no possibility of having levels of autism like this. But yes, we do have horrible, horrible diseases, and autism is just a horrible disease, and it destroys the lives of the parents as well as of the kid who has it, if it's a serious case. But it's very unlikely that antibiotics have anything to do with it, even though there is this weird connection with bacteria. Remember, antibiotics kill bacteria. You depend on those 100 trillion bacteria that are part of you. And there are some bacteria that can seriously affect the way we feel and the way that we think. For example, there is a bacteria called toxoplasmosis, or an illness caused by a bacteria. And toxoplasmosis we get from cats. And toxoplasmosis works like this. It spends part of its life in cats and part of its life in rodents, in rats or mice. When the toxoplasmosis is in a mouse, it needs to get to a cat to finish its life cycle. So what does it do? Normal mice are afraid of the smell of cat urine. But mice that have toxoplasmosis have their behavior and their perceptions altered. So they don't find cat urine scary anymore. The result is they spend an unwise amount of time around cats. So what do the cats do when these mice spend time around them? They eat them. And when they eat them, guess what happens? The toxoplasmosis makes it back into their system again.
So, and it's cat specific? No other animal would work?
Mouse, it is cat and mouse specific.
That's just strange.
And it alters their behavior. There's another bacteria that spends part of its life in ants and part of its life in sheep. So when it's in an ant, how does it get back into a sheep? Well, it drives the ant crazy. And it drives the ant crazy in a very specific way. It changes the ant's behavior so the ant crawls for seemingly no reason whatsoever to the very top of a blade of grass. Now, what do sheep eat? They eat grass. What does that mean their noses are in when they're eating? Grass. So what do they inhale? An ant or swallow. So bacteria can reshape the way that we behave or the way that we feel or the way that we perceive. And bacteria are in our gut, and those bacteria are affected by antibiotics. But this is a relatively new area of study. Even though we've known this about cats and rats for 5 years, we've known this about ants and sheep for 20 years or 30 years. But it is very unlikely from all of the evidence. The likelihood, based on the overall picture of the fact that we've more than doubled our lifespan, is these things, on the whole, are very good for us. And we are very lucky we have them.
You know what? This has been a fast 2 hours. You got 2 minutes. All right, minute 45. Tell us about your new book. Tell us where we can get it.
Basically asks the following question. I'm an atheist, so that gives me a problem. If God did not say, let there be light, where did light come from? If God did not part the heavens and the earth, how in the world did we get heavens and earths? How in the world did an inanimate cosmos with no creator cough out atoms, galaxies, stars, human beings, ants, bacteria?
All this stuff.
Yeah, and that is an enormous problem that my fellow scientists are not confronting. And one of the reasons they're not confronting it is because their system of logic, which they inherited from Aristotle, 2,300 years ago, is wrong.
Oh, boy.
This book tries to point you in the direction of a whole new kind of logic and utterly change the way you think about everything around you.
Where can we get it? Where can we get it? We're running out of time. Going to heartbreak.
Amazon.com or your local Barnes & Noble.
The God Problem.
How a Godless Cosmos Creates.
Your website is?
HowardBloom.net.
You're the best, Howard. Thanks. It was a great chat.
John, you're terrific. Have a great night.
Take care, will you? All right. On the other side of the coin is Andreas Bachmeier. His book, Vaccine Free, 111 Stories of Unvaccinated Children. We'll get into it. The other side. On the other side. This is Coast.